CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Dan Rocker will be telling us about the International Periuresis Association. So, can you tell me a little bit about the work of the association?
Sure. The International Periuresis Association is an organization that was founded in 1996 to both provide instrumental support for, workshops for individuals with the social anxiety disorder of periuresis, and also to generally advocate for them because periuresis is a disability that can actually accidentally get you fired, or I should say, get you fired for doing things that you're not really doing. And I can go into some more detail about that later if you would like. So what it functionally looks like. My organization puts on, I'll be doing one this Saturday. We put on workshops that are either virtual. I think we have 15 people signed up for an 8-hour, the virtual workshops are all 8 hours in duration, and I do them on Saturdays. And, probably 4 or 5 times a year for the virtual ones. And I basically give people, an understanding of the disorder, what's actually going on during the anxiety cycle as they're becoming anxious. And then we provide them opportunities during the workshops to actually practice urinating in the virtual presence. I just used air quotes for a moment, but in the virtual presence of other people who are on the workshop. It's a Zoom format just like this. We'll break people up into Zoom breakout rooms, and they can bring their laptops into the bathrooms with them as they endeavor to urinate to try to face the challenge, the anxiety, the specific trigger, the fear of urinating while someone is aware that they're trying to do so.
So how does the association reach out to the affected population to let them know that there is support and they're not alone in the struggle?
That's wonderful that you use the expression you're not alone or they're not alone in the struggle, because that's what's on our splash page of our website, which you can go to. It's Periuresis, that's P-A-R-U-R-E-S-I-S, periuresis.org. And we also just recently sent out flyers to a few hundred of the largest urology practices in the United States, just a little poster that they could put in their break room, discussing what periuresis is, because very frequently, individuals, I would say most frequently, people tend not to be all that psychologically minded, and if they recognize that they're having a problem urinating, they assume it's a urinary problem, and so they go to see their GP or their urologist, and that's kind of where the problem tends to start. The problem starts with the individual, but the misdiagnosis tends to start when they show up at a GP's office, at a urologist's office, because most GPs and urologists are not trained to be niche psychotherapists who handle a very special specialty, a very narrow specialty. And so if they hear that someone's having a difficulty urinating, they're going to either assume that it's a pelvic floor dysfunction, which in some cases it might be, or there might be a bladder neck dysfunction, which in some cases it might be. It just so happens that for people with paruresis, those aren't the, there isn't an organic basis. It's a psychological problem. It is solely mediated by a social environment. Paruresis is listed in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, as a diagnostic feature of social anxiety disorder. So if you'd like, I can tell you, for your listeners, the one question rule in that I would ask a client,
sure,
if to determine whether they, you know, if they think they have paruresis. Would you like to hear that question?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what I would ask a client is, do you ever have this problem when you are at home alone and under no time pressure? And if the answer to the question is yes, then they may have a urologic problem because there isn't a society you're performing for and fearing it that you're being judged by if you're at home alone and under no time pressure. People with paruresis will answer that question no. Oh, well, if my wife's out of town and I know she's not coming back, you know, I pee completely normally at home. That person, in most likelihood, has paruresis because you have the same bladder and the same bladder neck and the same urethra when you're at home as when you're at work or at your friend's house. So, you know, if the problem is situational, I'd encourage people to think, yeah, this is probably psychological.
So I'd imagine that if it is the psychological diagnosis, that would create numerous barriers in terms of employment and understanding as far as an employer goes.
Well, you know, it all depends on the specific employer. I'm in New York City, and there's a lot of Wall Street firms here, and most firms, you know, white-collar kind of jobs, you go to work for a law firm, you go to work for in the entertainment industry or on Wall Street, you know, they want to make sure you're not taking illegal drugs, so they will typically give you a pretty low-key drug screen on your way in. I remember my prior career was in finance, and when I got my job, you know, they just sent me down to a urine testing place, a Quest Diagnostics that was in the World Trade Center at the time. And, you know, you just go in there and urinate in a cup, and they just test it and make sure that you're not on drugs, and that's fine. What is more problematic and can really lead to employment difficulties and discrimination is when individuals who have paruresis are working at an, you know, say for a transportation company. And, you know, actually I've worked with individuals who are train drivers or truck drivers or pilots. They may be subject to a higher level of scrutiny for their drug test, particularly if they're unable to urinate for one of them. So imagine, I'll just give you an anecdote. Someone is a train driver for the MTA. Every year you have to pass a sleep apnea test to make sure you're not going to fall asleep while driving the train. And you have to pass a drug test. Well, passing that drug test it would be anxiety provoking enough as it is for someone with paruresis. But then you layer on top of the performance anxiety, the fact that it's mission critical, and if you don't urinate for this, you're going to lose your job. And so that tends to cause people to lock up. You would then think that, okay, you know, we recognize that paruresis is a psychological disability, and we do have it. My organization, we have and keep a copy on our website for anyone to use. An opinion letter from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC in the United States, that opines, it doesn't have the force of law, but it gives an opinion that paruresis should be considered a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act as amended. Surprisingly enough, because it's one governmental agency basically arguing with the other, despite the EEOC believing that paruresis is a disability, the Department of Transportation kind of doesn't. And the Department of Transportation creates drug testing protocols for the transportation industry. And then most other large corporations, rather than reinventing the wheel and coming up with their own policies, just use the DOT rules. And unfortunately, the DOT rules provide for, well, if you didn't urinate the first go-around because you had a shy bladder, you know, your second go-around is going to be what they call an observed collection. And you will have to urinate with your genitals out and someone observing the urine leaving your body and entering the collection vessel. And you will have 3 hours and 40 ounces of water with which to accomplish this feat. Now, you can come in as fluid loaded as you want, but if you fail that second go-around, and believe me, most people with paruresis, if they could will the urine out, or if they could just stick a catheter in and get it out, they would be demonstrating that they are not on drugs. They are just extremely stressed out. And unfortunately, they can't do that. And catheters are not allowed as a part of this procedure. And I have unfortunately worked with individuals who have been fired from good jobs that they love because they were unable to provide a urine sample on command that would have proven exactly what the MTA wanted, which is that they weren't on drugs. So, you know, that is a major issue. That is one of the major challenges that the IPA has been facing for years. And for about 15 years, we have been slowly and methodically trying to advocate within the American government to try to get the Department of Transportation to change their drug testing protocol. And we may have had some success in that endeavor insofar as the DOT proposed a rule change earlier this year that was in part, they never tell you exactly, you know, what influenced it, but I have to imagine that it was in part influenced by our repeated entreaties over the last 15 years. You know, come on, you guys are firing people for having a disability. It's not right. But, you know, so that rule change was on the DOT's website, open for public commentary until March 30th of this year, or of last year of 2022. I'm not sure when the final ruling will come down, but it's going to make a huge difference to people with paruresis if they can be tested for drugs by hair sample, by saliva sample, by blood. There are many alternate ways of testing for the presence of drugs in your bloodstream that don't involve urinating at close quarters in front of a stranger.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes, of course.
In this segment of our show, Liam Barber will be telling us about Kloot clothing. So, can you tell me a little bit about Kloot?
Okay, I'm Liam Barber, born with a disability called autism and autistic and speech impairment. I grew up in Niagara Falls, and my parents got me at when I was 10, 7 years old at a young age. My mom passed with stage 4 cancer, and in 2007 my dad passed in sleep apnea and died in sleep in 2005, 2 years apart. When I was getting older, I started learning about Nike and fashion clothing and clothing lines and designer stuff and designer shoes. And then when I do high school, when I got to high school, when I was looking at everything, I started doing editing, doing designing courses and graphic designing and beginning learning about fashion and all the stylish and all the clothing coming up in the US. And growing up in a big city and moving to another home and being close to family. And when I moved from my grandmother after everything, she was sick, so it was time for her to move on. And when I was dealing with this mental health, and I started to talk to my brother, and I was like, how do you feel like doing like a clothing line business together? Like, I could be the founder and ownership. And so I said, well, let me think about writing and come up with ideas. So we both, so I with Kloot Clothing stands for me and my brother, and that's the only half important to me. So, I came with CL for Chasing Liam. And then I added so I looked for animals and letters and bed. So I came with those and added a T. So for Kloot, and then I asked my brother, I had clue which we had that clothing, so we had clothing together, and we first launched clothing, we reached about 30,000 people on our platforms,
so,
and we're so within 15 minutes.
So I'm curious, as a clothing designer with, as you mentioned, mental health concerns, did you find that doing the design was in any way therapeutic for you? Would it have a positive impact on your mental health?
Yeah, it helped me with the polish and everything, and it's helped me better solution coming back into the mental health and helped me better and focus more and becoming a better founder.
Do you hope that with the clothing line, you'll be able to reach out to those with disabilities? If so, what would you like them to know about their own journey?
It needs to be themselves of who they are, what ability they're in, and for me as a co-founder, as a disability, I learned about born with, and for others who are born with ability and disability, they can reach their goals in life, and there's no change that everything there is, they dream about their opportunities and figure out their passion and their goals in life. It's okay to be different, it's okay to be changed, it's okay to be a gender, who they are, or anything. It's being the who we are and believe in yourself, and Clue stands for Clue Clothing, and we believe in ourselves, and we turn clothing to the fashion or the clothing or the accessories, and being different and helping ourselves to be who we are, and it's okay to be helping each other, and reaching your goals is successful, and it's okay to be different, and no matter what, is to believe in yourself and never give up on your hopes and dreams. You can always chase them, and you always can believe in them. So, and that's what I did. After I went out to health, I just came up, relaunched, and sold out again.
So, are your designs accessible for persons with disabilities?
Yeah, we got our, so we have a manufacturer team. We have about five of them in different cities, and in the States also, and I came up with the designs, and I designed them. So I draw on pictures, I draw on designs on paper, and design my softwares and my programs, and I just thought of being disability is a different goal, and do designing as designs for them.
What message would you send to the disability community about the need to keep pushing forward and finding one's own means of expression, as you found your designs to be something you could use to reshape the landscape? Do you have any advice for those who might be asking that same question? What can I do?
That's a good question. First is when the designs are for the people to into it or learning about their expressions of how they're feeling and learning about their ability or learning about their clothing on, is to believe in yourself of the who you are and of your personality, because you're a believer and successful, and you can reach your goals, and no matter what you are, you can dream about them, and you can accomplish them, and you can reach your goals and be successful, and then every step you take, every step your goal you make, and you believe in them, every success, and you're going to be successful of the dreams you want to be, and you reach out your goals and going to school, or learn on YouTube, or learn online, or learn on anything, to you learn about courses or learn about designing and learn about everything, because I started out with designing and I came up with goals, and no matter what, it's just believing who you are is successful, and you can always, no matter what in life, you'll be the person of the person you are today, and you are a believer of the person you are, and it's okay to be different, and no matter what, or designing or fashion or whatever you want to make, is your goals to do, and you can believe in yourself, you can really help, and you can really do, and believe in yourself.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
You're welcome.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Dan Rocker told us a little bit about paruresis, and we heard a little bit about Clute Clothing from Liam Barber. In this segment of our show, Don Morse will be telling us about Autism Anglers. So, can you tell me a little bit about Autism Anglers?
Yeah, Autism Anglers started in 2018, a couple years after my son, Landon, was diagnosed with autism. And it was a great way for me to be able to spread what autism is to people I know, and I've been in the fishing industry since 1994, so it was a really good outlet for me to spread the word on what it is, and it morphed from there into much more in 5 years.
So, do you find that being on the water and engaging in activities like fishing has a therapeutic aspect for those with autism?
Absolutely, and I actually... That was one of the big reasons I started it. I was working with a vets group down in South Florida, teaching them how to build fishing rods and also take them out fishing. And most of them, you know, afflicted with PTSD, and I saw the therapy aspect. And then, you know, once I started learning about autism, I figured, man, this is going to be a great thing too. It's just something to help rewire the brain for that short time, and it's worked really, really well.
So these days, how do you go about reaching out to the autism community to let them know about your work?
Yeah, so it's mostly on social media now. You know, we use Facebook, we use Instagram. We do have a website, autismanglers.org, that we use as well. You know, our main goal right now is growing. We've only been around for 5 years, and of course, you know, 2 years of that was during COVID. So that kind of slowed things down a bit. But our main goal, you know, always has been to let the angling community know what autism really is about. You know, it's not kids misbehaving, it's not anything that's controllable. So that's, you know, it's been our main goal from the get-go, is just sharing what autism really is. We also, in that same time, we started supplying free gear to autistic anglers. To date, we've sent out over 3,000 pounds of tackle free of charge all over North America. And now we are working, as we grow, we're working on also working on getting fishing trips for autistic anglers and their families all taken care of.
So, it's interesting you mentioned about getting the truth out there. What are some of the myths or misperceptions you run into about autism, and how do you go about speaking to actual facts versus what you may have read on the internet, for example?
But yeah, I mean, you know, sharing things like, you know, causes, you know, we still don't know, you know, why it happens. But, you know, people, you got your, you know, your anti-vaxxers saying, you know, vaccines cause autism and neglect. And I mean, there's a lot of things that people say cause autism, but really, you know, it's one of those things that is still, we're still working to figure out what it is. You know, it's a very complex brain disorder. You know, I used to be one of the guys that, you know, saw a kid misbehave and I was like, you know, keep your kid under control, not realizing, that it could actually be, an autism, you know, or related disability. So, it's just one of those things. It's, you know, lots of misconceptions. My son now is almost 11 years old actually. And, you know, he's totally different from some of our friends with autistic children. So, yeah, just tell everybody, you know, once you've met one person with autism, like you're here, you only met one person because every single one of them is different. And that's one quote that I use all the time.
So, do you use any modified training techniques or equipment for the fishing itself?
So one of the things that we do for the fishing rod is we definitely stress safety, especially, you know, with children that may not be paying attention, you know, as a neurotypical child would. So, you know, safety are what we push first. You know, barbless hooks. We always make sure that the child has a safety vest or can swim. We always make sure that the parent or guardian close to them. And 9 times out of 10, we also have a lanyard attached to the wrist of the child and the fishing rod, because a lot of times they're going to let go of it. So those are the biggest things, you know, safety and, of course, keeping our gear with us. But as far as anything different from what everybody else uses, you know, we find that, you know, most autistic anglers would prefer a push button, something easy to use type reel. But, you know, I know anglers on the spectrum that are professional bass and crappie fishermen, so they use all the latest high-tech equipment.
So, in your time with autism anglers, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Every time we get a picture or a letter from a parent or an autistic angler with the big smiles, that is a success. I always tell everybody, this is my second full-time job that I get paid for and nothing but smiles. So every smile is a huge success.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for programs such as this and equal inclusion of the autistic community, what would you say?
Go for it. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's something that you are passionate about and you think that it's good therapy, or, you know, can help anybody on the spectrum or anybody with special needs fit in, or just stop thinking about whatever their day-to-day, you know, I guess quirks, for lack of a better word, or, you know, just their day-to-day everything being the same. If you can help change that, make them smile, get them into something different, go for it. I mean, horseback riding, fishing, it doesn't matter what it is, just get out there and do it, because I guarantee that somebody on the spectrum or somebody with special needs will benefit from it.
So, do you have any advice for any parents out there who might be dealing with a fresh autism diagnosis?
That's a hard one. I've been asked that several times. The biggest thing is, you know, number one, no, it's not your fault. It's not anything that you did. Number two, it's your child, you know, just love them the way they are. Learn all you can, you know, wrap yourself up into parents, groups that are dealing with the same thing. You know, reach out to people with autistic kids. Honestly, you know, we've been dealing with this now for 6 years, and I wouldn't change a thing about Landon. He is amazing, absolutely amazing. I couldn't imagine him being any other way.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely, thank you.
Of course. You know, my friends, I think Liam's story is one that resonates a great deal in the disability community, for it's all about finding your niche, finding out where you belong. Yeah, sometimes at first glance, people might assume that a person with a disability is different because of how they see or hear or think or what have you. But the truth is, they're doing just as anyone would, living true to their nature. And it's not up to us to say that they are more or less capable based on any one factor in their lives. But if you find a creative outlet for your gifts, and I guarantee every person with a disability does have them, you can add greatly to the substance of our community. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.